Well, I got to tell you this story because this whole idea of the sweet stuff is just too tempting to tell it. I am always saying to my congregation to bring desserts, and like the theme of like next week's meal will be desserts and so forth. And so we had this one dinner, and there was nothing on the dessert table. I mean, literally nothing on the dessert table. I mean, to speak of. Right? And so I got up on the chair and caught everybody's attention and said that, we have quite a deficiency here that we need to remedy. So I'm okay with the sweet stuff. All right. Anyway, I want to talk to you about decision making and the will of God. Now, maybe this is a topic that you've heard about before and you're well versed in. Humor me. Okay? I think it's a topic that we can always be reminded of and glean from, and so hopefully you'll be able to glean something from today's class. So let's pray first, and then we'll get right to it. Okay, Father in heaven, we are so thankful for this day, for the time you've given. We're so thankful for the Lord's Day, that day of rest that you give us 1 and 7, that we might recline in your presence and worship you. Father, we're thankful that we can be together and that we can invest ourselves in the study of your word and things pertaining to it. Bless us now, Father, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. So I want to talk to you about discerning the will of God. Now, one of the difficulties with our current culture when it comes to discerning the will of God are the competing views that are out there. The one view, and you've probably heard this before, is a view that says you have to hit the bullseye of God's will in order for you to be truly happy and fulfilled and satisfied. And that kind of teaching is pervasive. You see it in popular books. You see it in well-known books. For instance, I remember when I was teaching an introductory class for the New Testament. And I was teaching it at Fort Geneva College at a church that was nearby. And I had this one fellow come to me and say, "Look, I really need some counsel on dating and courting, and I'm not well versed in this." Young guy, and I said, "Well, what books have you read?" And I quickly learned that he had read all of the books that were out on courting and dating and all that sort of thing. So I thought, "I haven't read any of these things." I got married, I got converted and then got married pretty quickly after that, and so I didn't worry about the courting and the dating thing, right? From a Christian perspective, I did it. And so I got a couple of books and I started reading them. One of the books that I got was Josh Harris's book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, which I had on my coffee, which I had on my kitchen table while my mother-in-law came over one day. I said to Georgiana, I said, "I want you to know I kissed dating goodbye." She just shook her head. You didn't think that was very funny. Anyway, in that book, he's asking the question, who should I marry? What he's really asking is, who should I court in order to marry? And the answer that he gives to that question is this one. And there's another quote coming. Would I enjoy having a girlfriend right now? You bet. But with what I've learned as I've sought God's will for my life, I know that a relationship right now wouldn't be best for me or for the one I date. Now, a couple pages later, he says, page 48, he says, each of us will probably develop intimate relationships with several different people before God clearly indicates who to marry. Now, you know the question. How does God clearly indicate who we will marry or who we ought to marry? How does God do that? Right? And when you think about that question, that's not an isolated question. You think about questions regarding school and vocation, and you think about questions regarding where do I live? How do I discern God's will with regard to these kinds of questions? And oftentimes, when you think about these kinds of questions, one of the things that you have to remember is this. We oftentimes, or people who advocate this sort of a view of God's will, finding the bullseye, only think about the big questions. But when you think about discerning the will of God, one of the things that your method of discernment has to entail is, how do I discern the will of God in every decision of my life? I want you to think about this particular verse. It's well known. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. Now, I want you to think about that for just a minute. If I am to do everything, eating and drinking for the glory of God, then how can I say that my choice of a spouse, which is for the glory of God, is of any less value than what I choose to put in my mouth? If I'm to do everything to God's glory. So, for instance, I would say to you that when you talk to somebody who has this idea of the bullseye view of God's will, that I've got to hit the bullseye or I'm not going to be happy and satisfied in God's will. You know, sometimes you hear people talk like this and they'll say things like this, I'm married outside of God's will. And they'll come to you and they'll say this, they'll say, do you think that I should divorce my spouse because I'm not happy? I'm married outside of God's will. I know I did. I should have married somebody else and not this person. And that's why I'm so dissatisfied and unhappy. Now, we'll talk about that as we go on. But we need not just a method of decision-making that encompasses the big decisions, who will I marry and where will I live and where will I go to school, but we need a method of decision-making that will help me to decide what should I pick, the Lucky Charms or the Fruity Pebbles, right? I mean, I need to know what it is that I'm supposed to eat and drink to the glory of God. And in other words, I need a method of decision-making that will help me in that regard, okay? So, with that in mind, we need to start with the question, what is the will of God? What is the will of God? Now, we're not here talking about what is the faculty of willing like for God. We're not talking about that. That's a philosophical, theological question that we're not really involved in. We are asking the question, what is God's will? When we ask the question, what is the will of God? We're asking, what is it that He's planned? What is it that He's purposed for my life, for instance, in particular, and for yours? Well, Deuteronomy 29:29 is one of those passages that I think in any discussion about the will of God you have to start with. So why don't we start there, and we'll see there that there are two aspects to God's will. So somebody who's got a big booming voice that can look up Deuteronomy 29:29 and read that. Oh yeah, I knew you would pick somebody else out. You're always going to point to that other guy. Jackie's real good. Bible's closed. Who's got it? Go ahead. Oh, yeah. That's right. Go ahead. Okay. Now, if you were to think about that text, what are the two aspects that you could pull out of that text pretty easily? Don't look too deeply. What are the two aspects in that text? Yep, secret things and revealed things. There are secret things that belong to God, and there are things revealed that belong to us and to our children. And so when we think about discerning the will of God, one of the things that we're thinking about is what? We're thinking about the revealed will of God. We want to pursue the revealed will of God and not the secret things of God. Now, the temptation in the world, especially in the ancient world, I want to start there and then we'll move up to our own world. But the temptation in the ancient world was to not do that. And so when the people of Israel entered into the land, God warned them about this. Would you just flip to Deuteronomy 18 and read 9 through 14 since you're close to it? I jumped in that. How did I jump in that? You find that, and I'm going to have you read that in a minute. Deuteronomy 18. You find that and then we'll get there. So there was a temptation in the ancient world to invest in trying to discern the will of the gods or the will of one's God. Now, the temptation took these sorts of forms: rhabdomancy, hepatoscopy, and idolatry. You know what idolatry is. What's hepatoscopy? Hepatoscopy, you know it. Oh man, good job. Yeah, it was, you know, cutting open the animal and examining the liver. And the lines on the liver would tell you the future or divine for you what you wanted to know. And then there's rhabdomancy. Does anybody know what that is? Well, that's not the rhabdomancy that I'm thinking of. There may be some other meaning to it, but I'm thinking of the rhabdomancy that I am familiar with and that you probably are too is the diviner rod. right? Now that morphed and evolved. That was shaking arrows, right? That was what it was. Rhabdomancy was when you shake arrows. Now, you see all of these things in Ezekiel 21:21. For the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the way, at the head of the two ways, to use divination. He shakes the arrows, there's rhabdomancy. He consults the household idols, there's idolatry, and he looks at the liver. And now, think about that. This passage is really one of those passages that you go, oh, this is really good. Because he's trying to divine which way to go. But the idea in the whole passage is God sovereignly superintends where this man is going to go. But this man thinks that because he examines a liver, he's going to find out which way he ought to go, one of these two paths. But that's the kind of temptation that was in ancient Israel. And one of the things that God said to his people when they went into the land was, don't do this stuff. And that's when we come to Deuteronomy 18, 9 through 14. Would you read that for us? Okay. So he's warning the people of Israel, don't go into the land and do what they do. Don't divine. Don't try to interpret omens. Don't try to figure out the future. In other words, Deuteronomy 29:29, leave the secret things to God, and you invest yourself in the revealed will of God. Now, that's tough for us because we're born interpreters. We interpret things. I'm going to give you, I mentioned this yesterday, but this is something I give to my in my biblical interpretation class. I want you to look at this. What do you see? Some of you, I'm betting some of you see a dangerous picture. A guy holding his kid over a railing. And I'm betting some of you see a father holding his kid over top of a play train set that looks further away than it is. But every one of us immediately interpreted that picture. We said, what is that crazy guy doing? Or, oh, that's nice. Right? Because we're interpreters. We can't get away from it. And so, what about us when it comes to circumstances? The trade towers, right? The pull to interpret that life event was too great for some people who publicly got on the air and said, this is what God meant with that attack on the trade towers. This is what that event meant. Or how about the tsunami in the Indian Ocean several years ago? People were interpreting that it happened on the Lord's Day. The temptation to interpret that event was too great. How about snowstorms? I'll never forget. I had a lady in my congregation. I was driving over back and forth to Philadelphia every week for classes. And, in the midst of the semester, I had two snowstorms that were just blistering, ugly kind of things. And, the second snowstorm, the lady from the church came to me and she said, God is telling you something. And I said, well, tell me what he's telling me because I don't want to miss it. And she said, he's telling you that he doesn't want you to go to Westminster anymore. And I said, well, how do you get that? And she said, because of that snowstorm that you got caught in the other night. And I said, yeah, but the problem is, if I put two snowstorms into one pan of the scale and put 10 nice sunny days in the other pan, then how do I read that? How do I interpret one over against the other? She was an interpreter of events. How about tornadoes? I'll never forget this one. A tornado swept through my parents' hometown and knocked out, ironically, all the TVs on one block. And a gal in my church came to me and said, you know what that means. And I said, no, tell me what that means. And she said, you know, that means TVs ought to go. And I said, I'm not giving up mine for that. I don't know what you're talking about, right? But we're interpreters. We want to interpret life's events. We can't help it. But I want to ask you a question. How different is that from reading a liver? Really? How different is it from reading a liver? Because let me ask you a question. What kind of certainty can you have in reading the circumstances of life? Look at Acts 28, 4 and 6. And I'm not going to have you go here. You can jot these down. But remember, this is when the snake bit Paul in Malta. And remember what the native said? The native said, this man is a murderer, and he's going to die pretty soon because he's escaped justice, and he's here now, and that venomous snake, well, that is justice. And Paul lived. They were trying to read the circumstances of life. How about John 9, 2, and 3? Hey, Lord, who sinned, the parents or the man himself that he's blind? Reading life's events, trying to interpret circumstances. How about Philemon 15 and 16? You'll have to look that up. I don't remember what it says. Providence, this is what I think Thomas Watson said this. Providence is the Christian's diary, not his Bible. That's a great, that's not a word for word quote. I can't even tell you where I read it. I'm pretty sure it was Watson. But whoever said it, it's a great quote. Providence is a Christian's diary, not his Bible. But we oftentimes treat providence as if it is the Bible. And then we assign what? Infallible interpretations to life's events. This is what God means by this. And I don't know about you, but I find that virtually impossible to support. For instance, I'll tell you one. I had a friend of mine that was struggling through a call, wrestling with a call. There were some people that really wanted him to take the call in this particular area, and he decided he wasn't going to take the call. He decided that there were other factors that mitigated against taking that call. And somebody approached him and said this, the devil is trying to persuade you through these things to not take this call. Now, I want to know something. That sounds very pious. It always sounds pious when we say, well, God was up to this, or God was up to that, or the devil is trying to do this, or the devil's trying to do that. Now, you need to understand something. I don't doubt for a minute that God is up to something every minute of every second of every day, and I don't doubt for a minute that the devil is a roaring lion prowling about, seeking to devour. I don't deny those things. I just don't think that we're able to say with any sort of certainty that an event in life is for us to interpret with any sort of certainty. Maybe that man didn't take the call because he made a wise decision. Go figure. So if that's the case, then how do we talk? Well, I think the Bible provides it. 1 Thessalonians 3, 1 and 2. We thought it best. This is when Paul says, we went on from there because I think it was Timothy was not with them, and so they thought it best to go on. Philippians 2, 25 through 26, I thought it necessary to send, it's not Philemon, who is it? Not Onesimus. Who? Epaphroditus. I thought it necessary to send Epaphroditus back to you. I thought it necessary. Not, I read the providential signs and I discerned the meaning that I should send him back to you because this is God's will. I just thought it necessary. Thought it was best. That idea. So that, I think, gives us a pretty nice biblical framework to think about how we talk about things. We don't need to. We're not called to divine, read livers. We're not called to infallibly interpret the circumstances of life. We're called to live wisely. I'm giving away my hand at this point. We're called to live wisely in every circumstance of life. Now, how do we then understand providential circumstances? I'll tell you what a providential circumstance is. And a providential circumstance is any moment in life. What is it? There are contexts for searching and applying the revealed will of God. How about that? So the day-to-day stuff in which I live, which belongs to the secret will of God when it comes to what does it mean, is for me to live in and apply the revealed will of God. You know, the problem is that too often, what begins to happen is that people who do this sort of thing actually begin to read providences more than they read their Bible. And that's a problem, and it shouldn't be. So providential circumstances are a way for us to apply God's revealed will. Now, somebody is certainly going to say, well, what about fleeces and doors? You know what I mean? Aren't there fleeces in the Bible, and aren't there open and closed doors in the Bible? And yes, there are. So let's think about them for just a minute. Let's think, first of all, about fleecing. Let's say a few things about it. What did I do?
We're talking about fleecing.
Okay.
Like
Yeah. Yeah, that's not what I mean. Okay. So remember Gideon lays out a fleece. And he lays out a fleece and he says, God has appeared to him and says, this is what I want you to do. And Gideon says, not so sure about that. So I'm going to put out this fleece and let's make the ground dry and the fleece wet. And then the next night, let's make the ground wet and the fleece dry, you know, that sort of thing. So what's the problem with that? The problem with that is he's already been given the revealed will of God. He doubts it. He's not a good example. That's not a positive example for us to apply to our lives. Second of all, we fleece ourselves. Not in your way of thinking. We fleece ourselves. You know, why is it that we say stuff like this? We say, if I should ask for $5 from Dad, Grandma's going to call in 15 minutes. If Grandma calls in 15 minutes, I'll ask Dad for $5. Well, okay, why not say, I'm going to ask the President of the United States for $100,000 if the Governor of Pennsylvania calls me tomorrow. We easily, you know what I mean, right? We never fleece the impossible. We always fleece the feasible. And that's a problem, right? And we should, and that's just a problem with fleecing. And how in the world can you derive any certainty from it? I'll never forget when I was a high schooler. You know, when I was a high schooler, I wasn't a convert, but I lived in a Christian home, and so I understood these sorts of things, right? And my parents weren't fleecers or anything like that, in the best possible sense. But you know, it was always like, you know, if the phone rings twice between the hours of 6 and 7, I'm calling Tammy and I'm asking her out. You know what I mean? And then the phone wouldn't ring, and you're like, ugh. All right, I'm going to make it 6 to 8. You know? Right? And then the phone would ring, and you're like, get the phone before it rings a third time! You know, that sort of thing. It's crazy, you know? But that's, how can you have any certainty in that? What kind of certainty can you have in fleecing? You can't. What about doors? What about doors? Not talking about the rock group. If Carl Truman was here, he'd probably play a Doors tune at this point. Right? You know it. You know he would. But what about doors? Lots of verses here. Acts 14, 27 through 28. Somebody want to read that? Okay. And that's the kind of verse that you're going to see in the next two. Now, what I want you to notice is this. Would you just hang out there What I want you to notice is, I want you to notice a couple things. Oh, that's all right. I may have you read. I think I will have you read one of these verses. I want you to notice guidelines for thinking about doors. First of all, doors aren't a command. Would you read 2 Corinthians 2:12? That's an important one. 2 Corinthians 2:12. Oh, keep reading. Paul sinned, passed up an open door. I mean, that's what you have to say, right? If an open door is a command, you have to say Paul sinned because he didn't walk through the open door. He passed it by. An open door is not a command. An open door is an opportunity. Secondly, open doors will have negative factors. 1 Corinthians 16:9, there were enemies abounding, even though there was an open door. The best counsel that I can give you is redeem the time and live wisely. Use your opportunities wisely. When you have an open door, is it wise to walk through? If it is, walk through it. If it's not wise, if you determine it's not wise, then don't walk through it. It's as simple as that. I want to talk to you about a couple of things here, and really this is the meat and potatoes of what I'm saying, and so we've got about 9 minutes left or 14 minutes left. I know the parents leave at 25 after, so I'm shooting for that. But let's think about the method of decision-making that's wise. And then what I'm going to do is give you some criteria for wise decision-making. So first of all, the method. All P's. Okay? Purpose. Discern the purpose. What's the goal? Okay? So, for instance, when I was called to think about moving down to Gibsonia, that was the goal. So let's think about that goal. Let's think about that purpose. Priorities. There are other priorities besides moving. There may be a priority of staying. And there are certainly other priorities, other factors involved in that. What I have to do is know the purpose, and I have to prioritize all of those things. I have to know what I'm actually thinking about doing and not doing. Once I think about the priorities, I need to make a plan as to how in the world I'm going to approach this process, this process of decision making. How in the world am I going to implement godly strategies in my life at this point? Then I'm going to pray. Now, I put that there because it's, you know, man plans a step, God directs his ways. So I plan my steps, I submit them to the Lord. But you ought to be praying through the whole process, and I think you get that. Perseverance. I need to persevere in this because it's too easy. I just talked to somebody the other day who has a big decision to make. And I said, what are you doing? What are you doing to kind of work through the process? And this person told me this, I'm waiting for a feeling. I said, oh, waiting for a feeling. Why? Because I want to tell you something. This method takes work. It takes real thinking and investment to go through this process of making a decision wisely, the bigger decisions. And then you need to present, sometimes you need to present why it is that you made that decision that you made. Not always, but sometimes. Now, let's think about the criteria that one needs to put into practice. First of all, does it please God? You know what you're asking when you ask this question? You're asking about the revealed will of God. Have I examined the revealed will of God, and does it please God? Secondly, am I motivated by love? Am I motivated by love for others? We talked about that today. I am saved by a Christ who was alone so that I could be together with people. And am I thinking about others as I make the decisions I'm about to make? Have you considered your own desires? Now, I want you to, this does not sound godly or pious, but think about the eldership. If a man desires to be an elder, he desires a good thing. His desires are taken into account, right? And so think about your desires. I had a pastor tell me one time when I was young, he said, if you involve yourself in something that's contrary to your desires, he said, you'll be miserable. He said, find out what you have a passion for and do it. And I thought that was wise counsel, and I still do. Evaluate your present circumstances. They are the context in which you live. Those present circumstances may have a lot of things going on in them, and you have to evaluate them. Not read them or divine them, but assess them. For instance, somebody may say, I've got parents that are older, and I don't know if it's a good idea for me to move far away. You know what? My wife and I had an opportunity to move closer to Pittsburgh. We had at least one child at the time who needed a lot of medical attention, and we took it. That was one of the reasons why, that was one of the providential factors involved in our decision, was to get a little closer to Pittsburgh. And our days at clinic were a lot easier after that. Godly counsel. Seek it out. Ask others who will tell you the truth. You know, you have those cheerleaders around you who just tell you what you want to hear. They work it until they find out what you want to do, and then they say, I think you ought to do that. It's the really good friend who says, are you serious? You know, that sort of thing. And then you have to decide. You have to just plain old decide, and sometimes that's the hardest thing in the world to do. And I think one of the things you have to do, let me go back to perseverance, and that was under method. But perseverance actually is under, it's not under criteria, but once you decide, you've got to persevere. When we moved down to Gibsonia, one of the things that I wanted to do was sell our house before we moved down. And the session said, you can't do that. And I said, okay, well, we're going to bite the bullet and we're going to move down. It took us 2 years to sell our house. And that was a ball and chain around our neck. And yet, never once did I say, we made the wrong decision, you know. We walked through an open door, and we persevered. We said to ourselves, just like I said to myself driving over to Westminster when I met the snowstorm, this is a circumstance that I have to work through. So that factors into what I'm going to tell you next. There's general guidance I want to give you. First of all, when you're making a decision, you need to separate facts from problems. It's easy to make problems facts. It really is. You need to avoid moods because you can get really moody in this process. And what I want to tell you isn't something really important. If you make a less wise decision, if you make that less wise decision, and this is, and can I just say, this could be a marriage. If you think, wow, I didn't really think about not getting along with her parents. Okay, maybe that's it. And there was this other girl, and I got along well with her, and I got along well with her parents. But I married the girl, and I didn't get along well with her parents. And you say, it's a less wise decision I made. Well, guess what? Hey, guess what? You can actually make a less wise decision a great decision by how you act, having made the decision. Right? You know? It's on you, right? It's on you to redeem the time and the events and your decision. And then set a time. That's just a practical guideline. You got to set a time because you'll drag it out forever. Maybe that's autobiographical. You know, I drag it out forever. And then pray. Keep praying in the midst of all this. So we're about to 25 after. Do you have any questions or anything?